It's good to be among the living. All you look well. Healthy people make me feel sick. We're in Psalm chapter 49. Coming to the end of the Psalms dealing with the sons of Korah. The Psalm of the Sons of Korah. This is probably one of the most poignant of their Psalms, and maybe one of the most poignant of all of the Psalms, because it's causing us to reflect upon, to think upon, to meditate upon a very intense subject, and that is death. So he actually begins that way by saying, I'm going to be talking about something that it's kind of a dark place. And he begins to reflect upon it. He mentions a word and repeats a word a few times within the text, a word called Sheol, or we oftentimes pronounce it Sheol. A confusing word to many of us, and we'll talk about really probably the etymology of that particular word. But there is a reason in particular why I believe they mention it. It's because that within their family, a particular incident happened. And according to this particular psalm, we're not exactly sure when it's written, and I think that's for a reason. And the reason being is that God's not wanting us to think in times of the times, but he's wanting us to think about the event and how the event was just as close to them now as it would have been as close to them when it happened. So if you go all the way back to Numbers chapter 16, we go to that day of this great event that almost defines who Korah was. And very clear within the chapter of chapter 16 is that at one time they were a very proud and a very renowned group of men. Now, what's also interesting is this, that this particular incident takes place in the time in which the children of Israel were waiting to go into the promised land, and really a generation would have to die off in order for them to actually go in. So it wouldn't be them that would go in, but more their sons. They are, as it were, in the wilderness, waiting to die off. And so the book of Numbers exists. You would think that because you weren't going into the promised land, and because of your grumbling and complaining, that that would in some way, you know, be a lesson to you, that maybe you wouldn't do it anymore. But that's not true. And you would also think that because of the humbling that took place, i.e. you're now in the wilderness and not going into the promised land, that you wouldn't have a proud bone in your body. But that's not true either. And I think what's interesting is that you have these men that still consider themselves as grand and important and renowned in spite of all these things that are happening. It really demonstrates to us that that some people just will not be humble. And in every circumstance, they're going to somehow try to find a way to elevate themselves. The passage starts off in Numbers chapter 16, in which Korah and others, 250 of what we understand, rose up against Moses and Aaron in particular. Their grand beef is that, you know, what gives you the right to be better than us in the sense that you're ruling over us? And, you know, we're just as holy as you are. So that kind of comes out. If you look at the end of verse 2, it's clear that they are men of renown in this particular group. And they are seen as, you know, chosen and selective in the sense that they're also in high positions during this time. It says this in verse 3, though, that they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said, "You've gone far enough." Now, the statement in and of itself is saying that they're the ones that are trying to define the boundaries. And of course, the irony of it all is that they're not recognizing any boundaries. But he says, they say, you've gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, and every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord, speaking specifically to Moses and Aaron? Moses heard this, and he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is the one that he has chosen, basically. And it ends this way in verse 7, by him declaring, you have gone far enough, sons of Levi. Probably the better way of putting it in the Hebrew is, it is much for you, or too much for you, to go this far. So the point of the matter is that they're not recognizing any boundaries. Moses then calls them out, and he says, okay, so what I want you to do, and once again, if you look in verse 9, it is not enough that for you that God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation, given you the positions that he has. You want the highest of positions, and you've grumbled against God's choice and against God, really. So Moses sends out a summons to them, but they respond, if you look in verse 12, by saying what? Yeah, you're not going to tell us what to do. You just want to lord it over us. You look at the end of verse 13. What does he say? The end of verse 13. You just want to lord. You know, you just want to be bossy. And how does it end, verse 14? Yeah, we're not coming. We're not coming. So Moses is really upset, and God says, "Well, invite them to bring their fire pans." You know, I mean, you know, they say that they're holy unto the Lord, and they can, you know, bring an offering to the Lord that's acceptable. Tell them to bring them. So they'll come out for that. You know, they won't be called on the carpet. Of course, they don't think they're going to be called on the carpet for this. And basically, God is saying, you know, we'll see who's acceptable before me. Of course, God is very clear with Moses. Says, you want to make sure you get away from these people, because hell's going to break loose. So it says in verse 20, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourself from among this congregation that I may consume them instantly. Then the congregation begin to fall on their face, and they say, oh, whoa, 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 we're not with them, which is basically what I would say. I don't know these guys. When one man sins, will you be angry with all of us? So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get back from among the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses arose, went down, and they bring along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. Now, initially, the thought is that all of them are going to die too, but that's not what's going to happen. But Moses said, verse 29, if these men die, the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings something entirely new, something new like the ground opens its mouth, swallows them up, and all theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol. So then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. And it came about as he finished speaking with all the words, and that the ground that was under them began to split open. Just imagine this particular event. The earth opened its mouth. Now, there's a reason why the imagery is given the way it is, but the earth opened its mouth, swallowed them up, their households, and all the men who belonged to Korah. Now, it's very specific, all the men who belonged to Korah. And it wants you to know as well their possessions. Now, there's a reason for that, too. It says, verse 33, by the way, just a side note, if you look in Numbers 26:11, when we're going through genealogies, pick up verse 9 of chapter 26 of Numbers. The sons of Eliab, it begins to mention the different ones, called by the congregation who contended against Moses and against Aaron. in the company of Korah, and they contended against the Lord. The earth opened its mouth, swallowed them up with Korah. When the company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, so that became a warning. The sons of Korah, however,
did not die.
Okay, so I wasn't just talking off the top of my head. So as you go on, it says that the fire came forth. If you look, and here again, like I said, the imagery, the earth opening its mouth, swallowing them up, their possessions, and then verse 33, all that belonged to them, and then they go into Sheol, and there's Sheol mentioned again, and it says, all that belonged went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly, and all Israel, verse 34, who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, the earth may swallow us up. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. Now here again, if you drop on down to verse 38, as for the census of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives. So there are just a couple of words I want you to note. First of all, obviously, the mouth opened up of the earth, swallowed them like possessions, swallowed up, consumed, and then cost. All of these words are there for a purpose, and that is because man has a tendency of never being satisfied. And Sheol or Sheol is a picture of a place that is never satisfied. It's where people that are never satisfied go, right? They are not content with the boundaries. You have gone far enough. As you look in the book of Jude, angels in the deepest part of the pit who did not keep their proper abode. You can't tell me what to do. See, and the fact that their possessions are part of their prize, their positions are part of their praise, is all part of that consuming desire to swallow up more. So it's an interesting picture that is really given. And Proverbs, if you look with me, in Proverbs chapter 30, will kind of give you the same kind of picture for Sheol in this particular, which oftentimes is defined as the netherworld or the place of the dead, but doesn't really go into what it's really about or the etymology of the word. But if you look in Proverbs 30, it kind of hits upon it. And it says this in verse 15, the leech has two daughters. What are their names? Okay, so there are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. Sheol is one of them. And if you see attached to that in verse 16, and fire that never says enough. Very interesting that they put the two together. When we come to chapter 49, Sheol is going to be mentioned at least twice within the text, if not more. And the emphasis obviously is going to be on going to this place that is consuming. Now, just to kind of give you a little background on this particular word, which in chapter 49, if you look in Psalms chapter 49, he makes mention in verse 14 that the foolish as well as the wise or whatever, everybody is basically heading for this place appointed as this place of Sheol. And if you look in verse 14, mentioned at least twice within that particular verse, his direct connection, obviously, is there with his family, or there with their family. And it's a point of deep reflection. This is not just anybody writing about this. This is a family with a history. And somebody has come out with a lesson, and wants us to think about something that they have been brought to task to think about. So it's one of the reasons why it's so poignant in that respect. The etymology of the word Sheol is actually, strangely enough, comes from a root word that has to do with begging or asking. It is directly tied with a picture, if you can kind of think and picture your mind, of like a bottomless pit. So that the picture of it is that you never get anything you truly want. It's a place of forever asking, but forever not getting. A place where wishes never come true. And it's described in, if you look with me in Luke chapter 16, you remember the story of the rich man and the poor man, right? Whose name is remembered, which is interesting within the passage, because the rich man, you would think his name would be remembered. Do you know the rich man's name? No, you don't know the rich man's name. Do you know the poor man's name?
Lazarus.
Yeah, Lazarus. But it says in verse 19, there was a certain rich man. He habitually dressed in purple, fine linen, gaily living in splendor every day. And yet he passed this poor person. He finally ends up in Hades in verse 23. He lifts up his eyes in torment, and he begins to cry out. And what is he crying out for? Well, I'm in agony in this flame. I just need you. So this is a request. Dip your finger in water and cool off my tongue. That's a request. Abraham says, not going to happen. If you drop on down to verse 27, and he said, then I beg you, Father. And in many respects, it's kind of the same picture of where Sheol gets his name, a place of begging, always needing, always wanting, never satisfied. So an interesting picture, and it's going to be interjected within Psalm chapter 49. As you start off the psalm in Psalm chapter 49, I think one question that immediately arises as you read through it is the question of how much does forever cost? And, you know, Matthew, one of the great parallels to this text, I think, Matthew 16, 26, you know, what is a profit a man if he gains the whole world and he loses his own soul? So how much does forever cost? Well, in some way, he's going to be contemplating that. But as he contemplates certain issues that seem to be obvious on the surface of this text, which, you know, are obviously things that they want us to grab onto. But there are certain things that he wants us to contemplate and certain things that are hidden that you can only find through meditation. So we're going to be talking about that because the fundamental thing that he's trying to get across can easily be missed as you read through this if, in fact, you don't take some time to work through it. So we start off in verse 1. He's obvious that he's writing to just some people. Everybody needs to know this. So it's a subject that is very important to everybody, and everybody needs to give ear. And the phrase here and the word that he uses is to be noted. And the tendency is that certain words we go, I know what that means, I know what that means, I know what that means. So most of the words in that first verse, you do. You know what they mean. I mean, hear this, all peoples. Yeah, you're probably right on all of that. Give ear, all inhabitants. Yeah, you're probably right on all that. Because he's talking about the things that you need to listen to. But the way he ends this is, give ear, all inhabitants of the world. That's a different word. And the word in and of itself is a word that is often translated as transient. It literally is interpreted, which we would think, well, he's talking about the earth, or he's talking about the globe, or he's talking about the people on the earth. No, he's talking about time. All you who live in a transient age is actually the text. You'll see this word another place. It's found in Psalm 89, if you look with me, just to give you an example of this, and then we'll go back. But Psalm chapter 89, we'll pick up in verse 46. How long, O Lord, wilt thou hide thyself forever? Will thy wrath burn like fire? Verse 47, remember what my span of life is. Span of life is the same word for world. Keled. So it's a very interesting word that is being used here. And it is there to really, if you were to translate it directly from the Hebrew, it would mean gliding away. So all you who live in a place that slides away from you. When I was a kid, there was a old rock song that went something like slip sliding away. Okay, so that's basically the picture within the passage. Give ear, all inhabitants of you who live in a place that is not here long. Now, the fact that he's writing to everybody was obviously clear at the very beginning, but he's wanting to hit every spectrum of this. So he starts off and he says, both low and high. Once again, the Hebrew, very interesting. It starts off, Ben Adam, which is son of Adam. So that would be low, because he's son of dirt. And Ben Ish, which is a honorable, noble guy. So dirt, or whether you're dirt or noble or important, doesn't matter. Both low and high is the phrase that way that it's translated in the text. Both rich, honorable and noble, and both poor, somebody that is maybe wretched, or could be in poverty, but somebody that maybe is wretched in their spirit. It doesn't matter. And what he's establishing in this text is very important, because when you and I start reading certain passages about certain people trusting in their wealth, we're going to have a tendency to think, well, they're not talking about me. Okay, so he doesn't want you thinking that way. So both low and high, both rich and poor together, my mouth will speak wisdom. I'm speaking to somebody skilled on the subject. I've been there, done that, is basically what he's talking about. And the meditation of my heart will be inclined to understanding, or the pondering of my heart will be focused on insight. My desire is that you comprehend. I'm going to do this very skillfully, but I'm going to be speaking in such a way that I want you to really have insight. And that's not always easy. I mean, you know, it's one thing to try to convey an idea. It's quite another thing to convey a spirit or heart. And he wants you to feel this. So my mouth will speak wisdom. My meditation of my heart will be understanding. And verse 4 is probably the key that will let us know what we're actually doing in the psalm. I will incline my ear to a proverb. Now, the proverb, of course, is not unlike the word in the New Testament that speaks of the word parable. And it is oftentimes a picture of putting two things side by side and paralleling together, so that there's an example here, an example there. In this particular context, though the word can actually be translated parable, and though proverb kind of hits upon it, the emphasis of the word seems to be, how can I put this? There's a English word called hemistich. And hemistich makes mention of the fact that you're placing only half of the idea out, so that the other half will be filled in as you begin to meditate on it. It's a kind of hemistich. But it's like half of a stick. So it starts off, I will incline my ear to understanding the other half. He's going to present us with something, and he's kind of wanting us to fill in the process. So that the whole process is you look at the end of verse 4, I will express or open up, I will open up a dark place, probably the best way I can put it. I open up a dark place for you and questions, and I'm going to do this on the harp. Now the harp is, many times it's making reference to a 10-string instrument, but the emphasis of the harp is more the plucking of the strings, are more the vibration of the soul. So the picture is perhaps with fear and trembling, but with deep emotion. And it's something shaking. See, that's why the harp was such an interesting picturesque, because something is shaking. And so obviously we're dealing with a psalm, and the emotions are being pulled upon. We'll use the phrase sometimes, pulling at your heartstrings. So maybe that's pulling at your harp strings. I don't know. But I will express something deep to you, and I want you to think deeply about it. I want it to move your soul. It's a riddle. So if you just read the psalm and you go, I got it, I know what he's talking about. Okay, you didn't get it. Okay. He starts off in verse 5, and I'm not trying to correct the translators. I'm just saying that sometimes they fill in the blanks, and sometimes the blanks aren't filled in. And, you know, there's a reason why certain things aren't put in. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying the word's not there. So if you look at the beginning of verse 5, why is not there. The phrase is just basically, should I fear? Do I have something to be afraid of? It's more the picture. Should I be afraid? And in many respects, as we go through the Psalms, he's going to be saying, you have good reason to be afraid. If, in fact, it was handed down to your family, and I watched my father get sucked in to hell alive, would that be meaningful to you? Would you walk away from that going, I don't think I have anything to be afraid of? Yeah. Should I be afraid? Should I fear the day of wrath, of calamity? Should I be concerned about the difficulties of life? When the iniquity of my foes surround me? Okay, here again, I'm not trying to retranslate. If you look at King James, it'll actually substitute the word foes for heel. It's kind of where we get the word Jacob, supplanter. So the translators, you know, saw heel, or supplanter in there, and it's like, well, those are the foes. Well, could be. And you wouldn't be off with that. But let me suggest this. When iniquity here is dealing with your twisted way of thinking, have you ever thought wrong? Okay, that's iniquity. It's like, I'm not even thinking straight. That's iniquity. Okay, not seeing things straight. It's twisted, convoluted. Okay, so when my convoluted thinking supplants me, that's what it's talking about. Now, it could be the convoluted thinking, and clearly within the context, I would probably agree with this. It could be the convoluted thinking that is being brought upon me by virtue of my surroundings and what the people are saying and the things people are doing. And that, therefore, would be the foes or the supplanters in my life that are supplanting me. The fundamental point here is that something's trying to trip me up. Something is supplanting me, is taking me away from what is valuable. This is going to be the key of the passage. Something's holding me back from attaining to those things that are most valuable. So should I fear in times of difficulty, when the twistedness of my life begins to supplant me and surround my thinking? And then he goes into verse 6, those who trust in their wealth and boast in their abundance of riches. Okay, so it all connected. There's a twisted way of thinking that has permeated my life. It's surrounding me. It's supplanting me. It's keeping me from thinking right, and it's keeping me really from embracing that which is valuable. What is the thinking? Well, verse 6, those who trust in their wealth. Now, lest, once again, you rule yourself out of this, remember, who is he writing to? Everybody, both low and high, rich and poor, it doesn't matter. So, you also have to understand that when he makes reference to trusting in their wealth, he's not just talking about monetary stuff. The word that he uses specifically in this text deals with the strength and the ability and even goes into the whole realm of a person's perspective of their own virtue. If you were to pull aside a Pharisee and you were to say, what is your greatest asset? He would say, my reputation as a Pharisee. Well, that's his wealth. See? So whatever you put your trust in is your wealth. It could be your prowess. You have a talent. You have an education. There's something in your life that, you know, I'm the best mom that ever lived, or you know, soccer mom or something. But something that you put your sense of, you know, this is who I am. This is who I am. Those who trust in that. There are those who trust in that, and there are those that boast in what? Now, the abundance is making reference to the fact that they're growing in whatever they're trusting in. So I'm becoming, I'm the greatest father in the world, and I'm becoming greater than anyone in the universe. I'm getting better at it, whatever. So whatever my perception is of my greatness, I'm not only trusting in it, I'm perceiving that I'm growing in it. And that's what I boast in. It's very important to understand this, because it's very easy to go, okay, we're just talking about rich people. Not just talking about rich people. I don't care who you are. No man, verse 7, it just immediately puts brakes on everything, doesn't it? No man can by any means pay for a friend, for a brother, for somebody he really cares for. You can't buy a soul, he puts within the text. And here again, what are you paying for? Well, it could be money, or it could be talent, or it could be ability, or it could be that maybe you're banking on that you're such a good person that somehow you're going to make sure that nothing ever happens to somebody that you love. Maybe that's it. But you better give that up. That's bad thinking. There's something wrong with that thinking. And in some respect, if you go back to verse 5, you remember iniquity? The twisted thinking is catching me on the hill, is supplanting me. Now, why is the hill a place of supplanting? I can tell you why. Because that's where you're the most vulnerable. to get tripped up. And that's where the serpent bites. So, you know, it's man thinking that he's invincible. And God goes, you're walking on the ground, aren't you? No man can by any means redeem his brother, pay for his brother, or give to God a price, a ransom for him. The redemption of his soul, nefesh, is not only making mention of the fact that he's a living being, but he's a very distinct living being. There's nobody like him. You know, you might could have another child, but never replace that person, because the distinction of that person could never be replaced. His emotions, his passions, the distinctive self that he is just one of a kind. His soul could not be replaced. He should cease trying forever. That he should live on eternally, forever. That he should not see decay or the grave or undergo decay, or in this particular text, the pit. You can never pay the debt. There's a cost somehow that's involved. It's interesting, you go back to that number 16, it makes reference to the fact that they paid the cost of their lives. Remember? He sees that even wise men die, stupid and the senseless alike perish. They leave their wealth to others, their abilities, their prowess, they hand down things, their traditions, whatever your wealth is. Their inner thought, making reference to, obviously, their emotions. Okay, this is very interesting, because verse 11 is making reference to the fact that they're thinking with their emotions. When it says their inner thought, it actually is their inner pals. But it's talking about their emotions. So they're thinking with their emotions. So their inner thought is, their houses are forever. Why do you think that what you're doing has a lasting effect? I don't know, I just feel it. My gut. Okay, that's there's nothing stable there. The inner thought is that their houses are forever, that their dwelling places, somehow I'm going to pass this on forever. I mean, I'm building a dynasty for my kids to follow after me, and I know exactly how it's going to go. I don't think so. And our thought is their houses are forever, their dwelling place to all generations, because you know why? Because I've picked the right thing. I picked the right path. They have called their lands after their own names. And then it says this in verse 12, which he's going to repeat at the end of the chapter. But man in his pomp will not endure. He is like a beast that perishes. Now, if you'll mark the word pomp, and you'll mark the word in verse 8, the redemption of his soul is what? Costly. Okay, the word costly is yakar. The word pomp is yakar. It's fundamentally the same word. The difference is that, and the reason why they translate it pomp in verse 12, is because it is establishing what men perceive as valuable. Therefore, it is just pompous. It is just bragging. It is just boasting and vain boasting. I mean, the fact of the matter is that verse 8, the redemption of somebody's soul is costly. It's a valuable thing. Soul is something valuable. Unfortunately, man thinks less about the value of a soul and thinks more about the value of his own imagination. His perception is I've got this all planned out. I know how it's going to go. I know what I've already thought this through. And God's going, okay, that's just arrogance. You're just parading a lie is the only thing you're doing. And you're putting your trust in, and you're saying to the world, this is valuable. Now, in many respects, when you go back to Numbers chapter 16, you have to understand that the whole Korah clan was seeing what was valuable to the fathers being paraded around. And had it not been for the grace of God to completely erase them off the face of the earth, generation after generation after generation after generation would have gone the way of the fathers. And it would have been forever doomed to a place of waste. But God in His grace drew the line and made the picture clear. So the sons of Korah goes, you know what? We contemplate these things. We think about this. And it's the grace of God that had brought us to understand that what they bragged about was nothing but waste. Interesting picture. Man in his pomp will not endure. His dreams are not lasting. They have no lasting effect. It's very important that you and I never come up with some kind of conclusion based on the way we think. Leave that alone. Stay away from that. Always come to conclusions based on what Scripture says. Because there's only one thing that's really solid. It's obviously not my feelings or emotions or my imagination. In verse 13, this is the way of those who are foolish. What? They brag about things that they feel emboldened about, empowered about. Somebody has an ability or talent, or they see things that maybe somebody else doesn't see, and they come up with these conclusions. This is the way of people that are foolish, of those after them who approve their words. You hear somebody say something with some facsimile of passion, and it seems like they know what they're talking about. But more than that, oftentimes they'll say things that in some way gratify you. You know, you're going to have everything I work so hard for, and I'm going to give, and you're just going, wow, that really sounds good to me. Instead of weighing the truth and the validity of what's being said, you're only approving the words based on, if you look at the phrase, and of those after them who accept as favorable the words in which they say, is really what he's talking about. They become a sheep appointing for Sheol. Because what has happened is, a beginning has started, that a father, a generation has begun to say, this is our strength, this is our ability. And God goes, okay, so where are you satisfied in that? And they say, never. We're going to get bigger, we're going to get stronger, we're going to get greater, we're going to get more. And when are you going to be satisfied with that? Never. So the only thing that you really produce is a sense of never satisfied. You're not really bringing fulfillment in the lives of people. You're just appointing them for a place of never being satisfied. Thus, they are appointed as sheep for where? For Sheol, right. It's a place to be consumed. A place of consuming, ever wanting, never satisfied place. As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. And the upright is the one that will prevail over them when the day breaks. Now, the upright within the text is making reference specifically to those that are pleasing to God. And his point is, don't you think you ought to be pleasing to God? The one who does control the value of the soul, the cost of the soul, and has the ability to redeem the soul. Their form shall be, if you look in the same verse here, their form shall be for Sheol. Now, here again, he's making reference to the images that they've made. Okay, so once again, let's just kind of go through it. You have an ability, you have a talent, you have money, you have things that you've built up, you've had things that you've put your hope in, your trust in. These are forms. These are pictures. These are ideas. These are idols that you've made. And you've made them not only gods, but your hope. You said, this is our hope. This is the hope for our family. Our family will always be this way. And so you've established these wonderful things for your family. You can't control anything. You not only can't control the breath in your nostrils, but obviously you can't control the future or your progeny. You can't control anything. But you already know that you've established this, see? So that the only thing that you've created is something to be forever consumed. You've been working all your life for firewood. That's what you've been working all your life for. Stuff that will be consumed. This is one of the reasons why it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, okay, the day will reveal it. The day, okay, the daybreak is going to reveal what's going to happen to the stuff that you've been, I mean, some people, hay, wood, stubble. Okay, so we're gonna throw it in the fire, see what happens. You know, some people, not only all they've worked for is stubble, they are only stubble. Because there's no value in our soul apart from Christ. When Scripture says Christ is on the Mount of Transfiguration, this is my beloved Son, he's the guy I'm pleased with. God has given you a hint. He's the only one I accept. Now you receive him, I accept you. Your value and your worth come from him. Their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have, watch the phrase, no, actually the word is, exalted, lofty abode. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol. Now, once again, the but is not in the text. So we'll just read it the way it is. God, will's not in the text, redeem my soul from the power of Sheol. There's a cry, and here again you have to understand that in the Old Testament, Christ did not come on the cross. So there is a hope, there is a longing for God to be the one to pay the price for my soul. The psalmist is turning to God and he goes, you're going to have to pay the price. Once again, for he will, it's not in the text, it just reads, receive me. So once again, we'll read verse 15. Redeem my soul from the power of Sheol. Receive me. It's really the cry of this individual, believing that if God doesn't pay the price, anything I can conjure up in my head, I mean, couldn't be of any value, no matter man's strength or his wisdom or his wealth. He has not the resource to avoid death. He has not the resource to maintain life. He can't buy forever. And the realization that maybe he's been investing in all the wrong stuff is now starting to hit him. Verse 16 reads this way. Do not be afraid when a man becomes rich, or more specifically, do not be afraid when a man is enriched by the fulfillment of his desires. We use the word success. Man, he looks successful. He set out to do this, and he did it. Boy, he's a great man. Not necessarily. See, this is where we go wrong in our thinking. You want to know why? Because man parades his successes, and before long, we begin to believe that his successes are successes. Remember the very interesting phrase, a failure has been a success in all the wrong things. So in this particular text, he's really conveying, okay, so what should I be afraid of? Why would Scripture say in verse 16, do not be afraid when a man becomes rich? Why would in Acts or Luke chapter 12, Matthew chapter 6, why would Jesus keep saying, don't worry if somebody gets more stuff? I mean, I'll take care of you. Don't worry about that kind of stuff. In fact, don't worry about if a man can take your life. Actually, worry about the person that can take your soul. Why would he keep saying, don't be afraid? And here's the point of the text. Something's trying to supplant us from that which is valuable. That which is most valuable is what? The soul. The soul. The forever existence of your individuality, who you are. I mean, that's, how valuable is that? And how could you ever keep something like that alive in the sense of there is a consuming force that destroys everything that is not done in a forever realm? God has so ordained that all the waste and everything will be just totally burned up because it's not worth anything. All the chaff has to be burned. Think of all the things that you've done that were just a waste. I mean, all you have to do is think today of all the things that you did. It was just a waste. Before long, it would not only consume what we did, it would consume us, because that's who we are. The passage is making reference to the fact that somehow my soul has to be worth something to somebody. And ultimately, if it's not worth something to God, because nobody else has any ability to really produce anything of any value, everything that they're producing is burning up, even though they brag about great and wonderful things, that they can do this and they can do that. They can't. So I can't put my hope in them. But there's something about the world in which they boast and they brag, and you look at them and you go, maybe I've been doing it wrong. And I think verse 16 is about that. Do not fear when man becomes successful, because the world is so good at the fanfare and the pomp and the parading. I mean, you turn on the TV and you go, now that's success, right? That's what's lasting. These people say they'll always be remembered. You know, could be a movie star that was a drug addict. Oh, we'll never forget him. They were so important in our lives. They taught you how to do drugs, you know. They taught you how to live in debauchery. Finally, we found somebody to take a stand about homosexuality. These are our heroes, and we lift them up, and we applaud them, and before long, the world begins to go, you know, well, before long, we get tripped up. Well, maybe I should be pursuing the same things. Do not be afraid when man is successful, when the glory of his house begins to get bigger. Because bigger is better, right? If a lot of bad things is very popular, then more bad things is even greater. For when he dies, none of that stuff is going with him, because nothing's valuable in anything he does. His glory, it doesn't say will not ascend. What does it say?
Descend.
Will not descend. Right. Will not descend after him. Though while he lives, he congratulates himself. Good job. Did a great job. And, hey, they even had a party for me, say I was great. And everybody praised me and said I did well for myself. And it matters not. But we think it does. And once you start thinking it does, that's where you get tripped up. The psalm is about the subtlety. You're going to miss it. It's about the subtlety of praise. How do I know that? Well, back up into chapter 47. Oh, clap your hands, all peoples. Shout to God the voice of joy, for the Lord Most High is to be feared. Great King over all the earth. Chapter 48, verse 1. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. Now, why then does he write chapter 49? Because he's demonstrating what man praises and the emptiness of that praise, but more specifically, the influence that praise has on people's lives. God, it's tripping me up. It's causing me. See, this is why it's important that you praise God. This is why it's important that you don't sit among people that are praising men. Because after a while, you begin to feel it entwining around your leg, and it begins to pull you under. And you begin to go, maybe I made a mistake following God. Demas thought that way, having loved this present world, left Paul. Though he lives and he congratulates himself, and though men praise you when you do well for yourself, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. My dad's always done this. His dad's always done this. This is the way our family's always done this. Okay. I wouldn't follow that. Because the hope isn't in the way your father did it, or your mother did it, or the way that your country did it. The hope is in God alone. If you put your trust in anything else, a man will boast and he'll brag about the strangest, dumbest things. And he'll perceive that he's on the right track, even to death. And he'll just take generation after generation after generation with him. It was the graciousness of God that just ended the whole thing of Korah's parents. And the sons of Korah go, we got the message and we're saved. That's the graciousness of God, isn't it? How does it end? Man, in his yakar, in that which he deems as magnificent and honorable and precious, and he parades it around, yet without any kind of insight, that unless God saves, there is no salvation, is like a beast that perishes. Nothing's following him. He leaves nothing, no inheritance, no nothing of value to anybody. And you look throughout the Gospel of Luke, one great theme that is being given is the warning of investing in the wrong things. And Jesus will even say to one man coming up to him, he says, beware of all kinds of greed. There's all kinds of greed. There's all kinds of avarice. There's all kinds of, you know, confidence in all kinds of things. It's not just about money. And God continues to warn. In fact, you know, as you go through, and I mean, it is in Luke that he gives a reference to the rich man there in Hades and believing, you know, I've done it all, I did it all wrong. But if you look at him, it seems as if he's doing it all right, because he's, you know, doing what he thinks is success. Hebrews chapter 9, if you'll turn there with me, and I'll close with this text. A favorite and wonderful phrase, if you pick up with me in verse 11. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 11, but when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, out of anything of this creation. And not through the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but through his own blood. He entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal payment. For if the blood of bulls and goats and ashes and heifer sprinkled those who have been defiled, sanctified for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more with the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve a living God. And for this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption, for the payment of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive a promise of what? Forever inheritance. How great is that? I could never pay. And to somehow convey to family members, to somehow convey that I'm the answer, that we're the ones, we got to stick together, it's all about us, is just false hope. And it's the grace of God that oftentimes we're not just swallowed alive into the waste. But I can tell you this, it would certainly be more gracious than if we were left alive and we were to detour people from the one hope. Father, give you thanks once again for this psalm that causes us to think about how valuable praise is and how easily it can thwart us and catch our heel when a man begins to parade his glory and the wonderful things that he does. Before long, we begin to believe it and we begin to fear that perhaps we've gone the wrong way. But this is not true. Great is the Lord. He's the one greatly to be praised. Our trust will always be in him. We do this in Jesus' name. Amen.